Well, the government might have been shut down, but the Supreme Court of the United States was still able to hear oral arguments on a number of important cases over the last couple of weeks. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and this hour we'll talk about some of these cases and the issues surrounding them. Three of the biggest ones involved the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from stationary sources like power plants. Campaign finance was another issue, and so was affirmative action. We're also going to talk about some news closer to home, particularly our state Supreme Court and its appetite for campaign donations from attorneys, including attorneys with cases pending before the court. My guest this hour is Adam Liptak, American journalist, lawyer, and instructor in law and journalism. He is currently the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. Adam Liptak, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Great to be here, Jim.
So let's start with the EPA. In 2007, the Supreme Court said the Environmental Protection Agency had the right to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. The EPA then acted in 2009 and put CO2 regulations into effect, and there were a number of court cases that resulted from that, being brought by, among others, owners of coal-fired power plants. So what is the court supposed to rule on this time? What's the case before the court?
So this is it's a complicated technical case, and they just agreed to hear it about a week ago. The regulations the EPA instituted after that 2007 decision you mentioned did several things. And in a way, from the environmentalist perspective, the good news is the court left most of it undisturbed. The court didn't have any problem with the EPA's finding that greenhouse gas emissions pose a danger to public health and safety. It didn't have a problem with EPA regulations of cars, so-called tailpipe emissions from new vehicles. The question the court agreed to hear was whether, in regulating cars, whether the EPA was also entitled to require stationary sources, factories and power plants and so on, to get permits that industry and states find to be difficult to obtain and they claim economically problematic. So you saw in all those different little buckets of issues, the court really focused in on one, but that question of permits for stationary sources could still turn out to be a big case. As I say, they just took the case last week. There has not been a briefing on the merits yet. They'll probably hear it in the spring, and we're a long ways off, almost certainly till June, till we get a decision.
Mm-hmm. I guess for the average person on the street, if CO2 is bad for the environment, what difference does it make whether it comes from the tailpipe of a moving automobile or the smokestack of a factory or a power plant?
Makes sense to me. What the other side would respond is Congress passed the Clean Air Act. It's supposed to work in a certain way. It's a fairly intricate statute. And unless the EPA issues regulations that fit within the statute, they say the Supreme Court should strike down the regulations and send the EPA back to the drawing board.
So, it is, again, I'm just trying to understand, as you say, this is an extremely complicated case, and we don't even really know all the merits yet, and we haven't heard any arguments, but there certainly has been a lot of coverage about it. There are arguments that still being made that that since carbon dioxide wasn't originally included as a pollutant in the original Clean Air Act, that the EPA doesn't have the authority to regulate it at all. That question would seem to have been settled already.
Yeah, we're past that issue.
Okay.
And the 2007 decision was quite controversial, and there are people who would like to relitigate it, but it doesn't look like the court's ready to do that.
Okay. But what they're saying is that, okay, you passed a regulation about cars, but you're trying to apply the same regulation to factories. You need to have a separate regulation? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. So the problem, to get into the weeds, is that the way the Clean Air Act is set up is to talk about traditional pollutants and parts per billion of pollutants, and it's a little hard to shoehorn greenhouse gas regulations into the Clean Air Act statutory framework. And so industry and some of the red states want to exploit that gap.
Yeah, because the chances of getting Congress to pass comprehensive legislation related to climate change and greenhouse gases would be virtually zero.
It sounds right to me.
Okay. All right. So we don't really know anything about what the court is thinking because no one's made any arguments yet.
This case is in its early days. There are other cases which have been fully briefed. Some of them argued, and it's even without this case, it would be a quite interesting term.
Well, let's talk about that because there's certainly a lot else to discuss. First, though, I want to give our callers a chance to join us at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Plenty to talk about with Supreme Court rulings. If you do have questions or want to bring up this pending EPA case, so feel free to do that. But there's a lot else going on. Significant rulings expected in the campaign finance and affirmative action areas. And, of course, we're also going to touch on a little bit some things that we're seeing reported in our own state related to campaign contributions from attorneys to justices of our state Supreme Court and the relationship between that and possibly some decisions going in favor of those attorneys who made contributions later on. We'll touch on all of those things this afternoon, or at least we'll try to. 800-486-8655, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Is the email address, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. So, before we leave the EPA thing, let's just say that the court says, yeah, you know, this really isn't working the way it's supposed to, and you're going to have to find a different way to regulate this. What would be the implications going forward?
Well, in the short term, it would leave a very significant part of the contributions to global warming unregulated. So were the court to strike down this kind of regulation of stationary sources, it would be a big setback for the EPA. But it would not stop it from promulgating new regulations. That process is quite time-consuming.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we will certainly be keeping our eye on that. So let's move on and talk about campaign finance. Citizens United unleashed a flood of unregulated campaign cash onto the political landscape. It gave corporations and similar organizations status as citizens, more or less, with regard to the First Amendment. Now, 3 years later, we have a new case awaiting a ruling. Talk about what this new case is about and how it's different from Citizens United.
So there are two main kinds of campaign finance regulation. Citizens United addressed one of them, which is independent spending. It said corporations and unions, as the individuals have long been able to do, that all these folks are able to spend independently of campaigns and say, put up TV ads saying, I support so-and-so, I oppose so-and-so. But this independent spending is uncoordinated with the campaign, at least in theory. And the court said that everybody has a First Amendment right to speak as much as they want independently of the candidate. So that's one main form of campaign finance regulation, that kind of independent spending. Now the court has turned its attention to an area where it has never struck down a federal limit on direct contributions to the candidate. So the key distinction is between independent spending on one hand, you know, saying you support the candidate on TV, and actually giving a check to the candidate. And in the actual giving a check contribution to the candidate area, the Supreme Court has always said that doesn't raise the same kind of First Amendment issues. In this new case argued October 8th, an Alabama businessman named Sean McCutcheon says he wants to be able to give more money to political candidates and committees. And he's not challenging the base limitation that most people are aware of, that you can't give more than $2,600 to a candidate in an election. He says, that's okay, I can live with $2,600. But there's also an overall limit of how much you can give to all candidates in an election, and that's roughly $48,000. So you can give $2,600 to the first guy, to the second guy, to the third guy, but at some point at 18 or 19 or wherever, you run out of money and you can no longer give to the 19th guy. And he says that doesn't make sense. He doesn't understand why there should be that kind of overall or aggregate limit, and he attacks that aggregate limit. And the justices seem fairly sympathetic to that idea. They don't really understand why it should be corrupting of the 19th person to receive the same amount as the first 18 got. But at the same time, this challenge to the second main pillar of campaign finance regulation, the direct contribution to candidates could be the beginning of the deregulation of that second part of campaign finance regulation.
Well, certainly no one is arguing that there isn't enough money in politics.
I interviewed Sean McCutcheon, and he makes that point. He thinks it's undercapitalized. He didn't say it, but others have, that you know, we spend more on advertising breakfast cereals than we do on the amount of money that goes into political speech or on campaigns. So there is a school of thought that we need more money.
Wow. So what's the argument on the other side?
The argument on the other side is that it's quite easy to get around these aggregate limits, and in effect they would destroy the basic limits, that there's an anti-circumvention problem, particularly once you put political party committees into the mix, which are also subject to aggregate limits. You can funnel a lot of money. People who support this kind of regulation say you can funnel a lot of money to a given candidate just by running it through a lot of different committees.
Well, I mean, some of the really basic campaign finance regulations came about after the whole Nixon debacle,
yeah,
and Watergate, and bags of cash going to Bebe Rebozo in Florida and things like that. And the idea was to make the process transparent, that we knew who was giving the money to whom, and we're trying to keep the system clean and avoid the appearance of impropriety. Well, I think that fig leaf is probably pretty much gone. But so basically then, if the Supreme Court sides with Mr. McCutcheon, we're back to where we were pre-1972.
Well, we're getting closer. And there's a funny kind of bootstrap argument made from Citizens United, which, as you said at the outset, seems to help allow a lot of secret money to flood into the system. McCutcheon and his allies, the Republican National Committee, say, listen, it's better not to have this money spent independently and secretly and in the dark. It's better to give it to the actual candidates and the actual political parties, so at least you know who's doing the talking, and at least there are fairly strict disclosure requirements about contributors on the direct contribution side.
Well, and the direct contributions are not tax deductible.
That's right.
So, I mean, if you give to some 501c4, you can write that off, I believe. I don't pretend to be a tax lawyer. Some of these things are deductible and some are not.
I'm out of my expertise in that area too, but I think.
Okay.
I'm not even going to venture a view. I don't know.
All right. Well, I should not have opened that door. I withdraw the question. We're going to continue this. I'm kind of surprised. Usually when we say campaign finance, the phones light up and the silence in the phone room is deafening. I'll give the number again just in case people forgot it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email works too. talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, and you can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question. What do you think about this? It's a really interesting argument that actually allowing people to give to as many candidates as they want and to as many political party groups as they want would actually increase transparency in political spending, that the real problem is all these shadowy pseudo nonprofit groups who spend all this money anonymously, millions and millions of dollars all the time, that we should be allowing people to give more money directly to candidates and political parties, and that's actually a better way to run the political system. Okay, there go the phones. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more with Adam Liptak and with you here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A new report says that Wisconsin Supreme Court justices tend to rule in favor of attorney donors, raising questions about the independence of Wisconsin's highest court. Coming up next hour on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert speak with the author of that report. We may touch on that topic just briefly here in this hour as we talk about what's going on in front of the United States Supreme Court and some decisions that are going to be coming out sometime shortly or whenever the court gets around to it. Oral arguments have been held in a number of key cases in spite of the government shutdown, and others are being brought before the court, and we've been talking about those this hour with Adam Liptak, who is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. 800 486-8655 is the number to call, 800-486-8655. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, or the Kathleen Show, Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen today, and she'll be back on Thursday. All right, so on this campaign finance thing, what kinds of questions came up during oral arguments that and the answers from the court that you said you thought the court was sympathetic? Is this going to split along the 5-4 kind of conservative liberal lines of the court, or how is this going to come down, do you think?
It looks that way. The court led by Chief Justice John Roberts, which has been in business since 2005, has had six major campaign finance cases so far, and it was 5-4 or 6-3 in all of them, and the five more conservative justices were in the majority in all of them, and all of them rejected the campaign finance regulation before them. So that, if history is any guide, that's a likely outcome in this new case, too. And my sense was that certainly we know that three of the justices, Scalia, Thomas and Kennedy, were quite hostile to this kind of regulation. The swing votes seemed to be the Chief Justice and Justice Alito, and the Chief Justice indicated that he might find a way to try to draw a line which doesn't go too far down the road, but was quite skeptical of the idea that you can give to a certain number of candidates but no more. And I think that's a good indication that we're likely to have probably a 5-4 decision striking mm-hmm. down that part of the law, saying you can give $2,600 to a certain number of candidates, but not more, because it is, in fact, a little hard to understand the justification for that.
Well, given the likelihood of that that outcome and what we've already seen with Citizens United, from your perspective as somebody who studied the law, is it possible for Congress to write any kind of campaign finance legislation that would pass constitutional muster, given the current makeup of the court?
I guess the short answer is nothing beyond what's already there. I don't know that the court is ready to go after base contribution limits, that kind of $2,600 limit to a given candidate, because the court does acknowledge that there are sums of money that will give rise to a sense of gratitude, if not corruption. So I think it's possible that those kinds of limits will stand. But even assuming, and this is quite, you know, at odds with reality, that Congress could agree on new laws, I don't think that new restrictions beyond those that already exist would find favor with the court.
All right. We've got some callers who want to join us. Let's go to the phones. We'll start in Appleton, where Scott has joined us. Scott, good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good afternoon, and thanks for my call. Let's just say that you could convince the media conglomerates in the United States to toe the line on a campaign to cut their revenue stream. I don't think that that's going to happen. Do you?
Not too likely, Adam Liptak. I don't think you would think that too likely
either. I think our revenue stream is dropping quite nicely even without our agreement.
Yeah. Okay. So Scott, what's your point here?
My point is it's going to be politics as usual. You're going to have Acme Media Conglomerate Corporation asking a congressman, do you really want to vote that way? Wink, wink.
Right. So
maybe
I'm not sure whether your point is about media companies or companies generally.
Yeah. Scott, I think the confusion is, are you just talking about media companies or are you talking about companies generally?
I'm talking about the means of which our politicians use to get their message out to the public. And that is the media, which these campaign ads that run are huge influxes of cash to them. And to see that possibly dry up, I don't think that that's going to be one of their most favorite things to have happen.
Well, I can't speak for everybody in the media, but our editorial page editorializes relentlessly in favor of campaign finance regulation and probably has not been appalled by a decision. This is the editorial page, not the news pages. But not been appalled by a decision since Bush v. Gore as much as it's been appalled by Citizens United. Mm-hmm. So I think at least my media company on the editorial side would cut in another direction.
Well, the vast majority of campaign cash that finds its way into the media is on television. So probably wouldn't affect the New York Times as much as it would, local television stations in New York and elsewhere
right.
across the country.
So that's an interesting question. In candor, I've never thought about it, whether there's not some glee in some parts of the media that there's more campaign money coming in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Scott, thanks for your insights this afternoon. Appreciate it. 800-486-8655. A line just opened up if you want to join us. We're talking about cases before the Supreme Court, and right now we're talking about one that involves campaign financing, a rather interesting case that asks why there should be a limit on the number of candidates individuals can support. And we're wondering what you think about that. Patrick in Green Bay, you'll be next. Patrick, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller, so please excuse my ignorance if I don't sound too intellectual. But here's my thought on the big picture of the idea of transparency on campaign funding. If you're going to support one person, why are you going to support 19 people? I don't understand that. And the other thing is, okay, if you're going to regulate the funding, are you not going and you're going to increase transparency, what's going to happen is all these people or entities or corporations or whatever or even international interests are going to dry up because the anonymity is gone. Wouldn't you say that that would be a reasonable result of this?
So let's think about each of these things, I apologize. So the first question was.
The first question was I'm not understanding.
You were asking why someone might give them more than one candidate.
In the same party?
Right.
Or
so Sean McCutcheon is a Republican activist. He wants Republicans to take over Congress. And he wants to contribute to every single Republican running for Congress. And you can say that's a good goal, a bad goal, but it's an understandable goal. As to whether anonymity increases contributions, and which way the interest against trying to root out corruption runs is a surprisingly complicated question. So as I was saying before, there's a school of thought that it's better to allow direct contributions to candidates because they have to be disclosed, whereas some of the super PAC money is not disclosed. There's also some scholarship that suggests that you get more corruption with disclosure because then the candidate knows where the money's coming from and knows whom to be grateful to. So it's a quite complicated area.
I guess, on the other hand, the candidate is in control of how the money gets spent and the message. And one of the arguments that some candidates have made against all these third-party expenditures is that things are said more or less on their behalf, a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that they can't control, but oftentimes get blamed for.
Yes, and candidates find that frustrating. And so they would rather have the money, even at the expense, probably, of having to disclose and so on.
Mm-hmm. All right, Patrick, thanks so much for that call. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. And we'll continue to take calls on anything related to something before the Supreme Court in this term. But I want to make sure that we also get into this affirmative action case, because that's another big case before the court. And Michigan, in 2006, there was a referendum. They approved a law that basically bans the use of racial criteria in college admissions. And that's now enshrined in the Michigan State Constitution. But there's been a court challenge to that, I guess you might expect. What are the issues in this case, and what would you care to speculate on the possible outcome there?
So Michigan is one of seven or eight states that in one form or another bans racial preferences in college admissions and often in hiring and so on. And on one level, the question in the case is whether that insistence on equal treatment violates the federal Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. And that's a, you know, it's a funny kind of question if you think about it. They're requiring equal treatment, but might violate equal protection. But what the challengers to the Michigan amendment say is that it's not fair that minorities are specially situated to have to pass a new constitutional amendment to get special consideration from the University of Michigan and other public institutions in Michigan, that children of alumni, athletes, cello players can just lobby the trustees that admissions criteria should be whatever they think they ought to be. But minorities are especially disadvantaged by this constitutional amendment and can't get it overturned short of passing their own constitutional amendment. The only eight justices sat on the case. Justice Kagan was recused. So there is a possibility of a 4-4 tie, which would uphold the Federal Appeals Court's decision, which upheld the Michigan, I'm sorry, struck down the Michigan ban on affirmative action. So a 4-4 tie would mean there would be affirmative action in Michigan, but the likely outcome is the four conservatives plus Justice Kennedy go the other way and say that Michigan's voters, like voters in other states, are entitled to say, we understand that we can have affirmative action if we want it. Thanks, but no thanks.
Okay. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. Lines will be opening up soon if you want to get in. And you can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and on Facebook, look for the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about decisions before that are or cases, rather, that are before the Supreme Court of the United States, some big ones. One just arriving at the court involving involving climate change and the ability of the EPA to regulate some types of greenhouse gas emissions. Another case that we've discussed already concerning campaign finance reform. And then the most recent one we've been talking about regards affirmative action and what's going on in the state of Michigan. All of that fodder for our discussion here. Let's take another call. And Peter in Baraboo. You'll be next. Peter, good afternoon.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate the insightfulness of the conversation and the continual splitting of hairs, which move us, I think, so far away from looking at the issues from an ethical perspective. States' rights versus federalism seems to have lost a frame of reference. I understood we had fought a civil war to clearly demonstrate that in the area of freedom, liberty, justice for all, those states that had opposed those issues were defeated and brought back into the Union under a unified constitution. My only comment is in splitting the hairs, I think we lose sight of some of the most important fundamental rights. And thank you for taking the call.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us with your insights today. Adam, what do you think?
I can't tell, notwithstanding Peter's eloquence, exactly what result that would end up in, say, the Michigan case. He's quite right that the Supreme Court can be frustrating in that there is a level of technical hair splitting that is frustrating to someone whose common sense would suggest a certain answer to a question. But when you apply this idea that there was a civil war, yes, and one of the lessons of the civil war is we wanted to root out racial discrimination, it's still not clear to me whether taking that idea and applying it to a state constitutional amendment that requires equal treatment but may be said to disadvantage minorities, which way that thinking cuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the court, the Supreme Court of the United States is not an equity court. I mean, they're not ruling on that basis. And I have a friend who's fond of saying that the law is not about right and wrong and justice and injustice. The law is about legal and illegal. So splitting hairs is par for the course.
Justice Holmes famously said, "My job is not to do justice. My job is to apply the law.
Mm-hmm. Peter, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Let's go to Shawno next and hear from Scott. Scott, good afternoon. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking the call. I want to go back to campaign finance return or reform for a moment. My take on the decision so far is that they come down firmly on the side, which I kind of disagree with, but understand the rationale, the side of personal liberty, and an individual ought to be able to be heard. If corporations are the same as individuals and it's a free speech argument, then I disagree with it, but I can go along with that or at least understand the rationale. Well, what do they say about the countervening argument? What has the court's response been to the fact that inevitably has the potential at least to lead to disproportionate representation by those with money, and that in and of itself is bad for the democracy? It seems to me to be that they ought to have something to say about the good of the many versus the good of the individual, and that there seems to be some balancing of the overall good, you know, versus individual liberties. And I'll take any response off the air.
Scott, thank you so much for that call. Adam?
So that's a very smart question, and I think I can try to characterize what the majority in Citizens United would say. I think they would quarrel with the premise. They would say that in a democracy, lots of speech about politics is good, that people can be trusted to distinguish good ideas from bad ideas, that simply because a rich person like Sheldon Adelson puts up a lot of ads, there's no reason to think that the average American can't view skeptically the messages they hear and make sense of it for themselves, and that we're better off not to have the government control who can talk how much, but to have a robust marketplace of ideas where people can go shopping and decide which ideas they want to adopt. And there's no particular reason to think that people are foolish enough to adopt a bad idea just because they've heard it many times on television.
Which, of course, flies directly in the face of all the research about how advertising actually works.
This does require a suspension of disbelief about, you know, how savvy people are.
Yeah,
there's a great quote attributed to Winston Churchill that says the best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the famous P.T. Barnum quote. Scott, thanks so much for that call. Let's go quickly to Ryan in Madison next. Ryan, good afternoon.
Hi. I just had a quick question on the campaign finance reform. So if I live in Madison, I'm allowed to vote for the mayor of Madison. I'm allowed to vote for the governor of Wisconsin. I'm not allowed to vote for the mayor of Green Bay or the governor of Illinois. Why, then, am I allowed to donate money to those campaigns when I do not live in the area where the outcome actually affects me?
Ryan, thanks for that. That's a pretty longstanding legal thing there. You can pretty much donate to anyone you want to to a limit.
I see the point, and in a different kind of regime, you might have limits on that. On the other hand, I don't think you'd say that you're not allowed to form a view about, you know, I live in Washington, but maybe I have a view about who should be the next governor of New York. And if I wanted to write about that, if I wanted to publish a book about that, if I wanted to put up a TV ad about that, I don't know what principle should stop me.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, thanks for that call. Phone lines are open right now if you want to continue our discussion about what's going on at the Supreme Court of the United States. We have Adam Liptak with us. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. You can join us as well at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. All ways to get in touch this afternoon. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen today. Coming up next hour on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard explore the emerging field of synthetic genomics. And a little later, they talk about income-based repayment plans as a way of reducing college debt. That's coming up on Central Time after 3 o'clock this afternoon. This hour, we're talking about what's going on in terms of cases before the Supreme Court of the United States. And my guest is Adam Liptak, American journalist, lawyer, and instructor in law and journalism. He's currently the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. 800-486-8655 is the number. Before we go back to calls, there have been a number of news reports coming up recently about the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and I know you've covered issues, similar issues in other states, so I'm hoping to get your insights here a little bit. There were two different stories. One was about the amounts of attorney cash coming into campaign coffers of Supreme Court justices. In Wisconsin, we elect our members of the state Supreme Court. And that pretty much, I believe, every justice has taken quite a bit of money. They ranked them, and I don't remember what the rankings were, and really that's irrelevant to the discussion. But then a subsequent story from the Center for Investigative Journalism came out and has been reported just in the last day or two that there are actually, we're talking about attorneys who made contributions having a more favorable hearing in front of the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And I just wanted to get your take on all of that before we move on here.
Yeah, so this follows from our campaign finance discussion fairly nicely. The U.S. is all but alone in doing what the rest of the world would think is a very, very weird thing, which is electing judges. And bad enough you elect them, the rest of the world would say, but you let them take money for their campaigns, and then those same justices sit on cases involving the people they took money from. That's very hard for, you know, someone from Europe or really from anywhere to get their heads around. What the very nice report from the Center for Investigative Journalism shows is that there's a correlation. This is not, correlation is not causation. It's not at all clear that justices change their votes depending on who gives the money. But it's fairly clear that there's some kind of correlation that people are giving to those justices who are likely to rule in their favor. And whatever you think about politicians voting in favor of people who give them money, that's a kind of politics I think we're more used to. Why justices who are able to step back from, disqualify themselves from, recuse themselves from cases, insist on sitting on cases involving people who've given themselves money is a question that a lot of ethics professors really struggle with.
The appearance of impropriety is huge.
I don't want to go too far down the road of expressing a view. It's hard to see how this can be a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll leave it there because suddenly our phone lines are full again. So let's talk to Bill and Nina this afternoon from the Fox Valley. Bill, go ahead.
Please comment on the issue of truthfulness in political ads, particularly with reference to the 2000 campaign and the Swift Boat ads that I think have been proven to be untruthful.
Any rule saying political advertising has to be true?
It varies by state. Libel laws certainly apply to political advertising, although libel cases are quite hard to win when we're talking about public figures, which all politicians are. There's no question that there's a lot of dubious information in campaign ads, and one would hope, but maybe, you know, it would be a foolish hope, that people who look at ads would not necessarily take them at face value, but do their own work in figuring out what the truth is.
And of course, if the ad I'm listening to reinforces a belief that I already hold, how likely am I to go and find out whether it was actually true?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember which I think it was Peter Orlick who writes about the writing of advertising on television and radio, said that the main purpose of most political advertising is to get your own troops to go out and vote or to prevent somebody else from voting. Those are basically the two most important aspects
right.
of political advertising to begin with.
Right. I mean, there is. there is some effort to persuade that rare independent swing voter, but there aren't very many of those people.
No, vanishing breed in these days. Patricia writes on Facebook, she says, as a retired teacher, I couldn't possibly donate even small amounts of money to more than a few candidates in an election cycle. Yet wealthy businessmen such as Mr. McCutcheon apparently have unlimited funds to donate. What is the effect of wealthy people having this ability and an ever-increasing breadth of influence?
You know, it depends who you talk to, but there is certainly a school of thought and substantial scholarship that at least on issues that are not particularly politically salient, you know, issues about the regulation of, say, the internet industry, that these large sums of money coming from one side or the other have an effect at the margins. So, you know, Larry Lessig at Harvard has written about this extensively, that there are settings in which politicians will do the bidding of people who have helped them get elected.
Thanks for that Facebook comment, Patricia. Let's go next to Sally, who's calling us from southwestern Wisconsin. Sally, go ahead. You're on the air.
Somebody called in a young man, and he was commenting about how come somebody outside of his district could donate or give funds to a candidate, and they didn't even live there. And I don't understand how. I mean, you know, you've got the law, but just logically, I mean, if you've got, you know, a small area of Wisconsin where the median income was $40,000 a year, and then you've got billionaires coming in and buying, I mean, beaucoup ads on the paper, on the news, on the TV and whatnot, and then they can lie, they get away with it. I mean, we live in Wisconsin. I've heard plenty of them, and so. I can't see how that's not buying an election. I can't see how that isn't. And the whole thing is then you've got all kinds of outside influences, people working all the time. They don't have time to look into all of it, blah, 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 really. And it's brainwashing, kind of like they do in the military. And
all right,
my dad was base commander, so.
Okay. Well, Sally, thanks for the call. Adam, what about it?
So, again, I drop it into two different categories. One is, and the earlier caller, I think, was making this point, it's a little harder to see why, if I live in State A, why I can be making contributions directly to a candidate in State B. On the other hand, what if he was my college roommate and I just wanted to support him because I think he's a good guy? I don't know that that's terribly offensive. Then the larger point is put aside campaign contributions and talk about independent spending. The argument on the other side is that the First Amendment specially protects speech about politics. It's at the core of what the First Amendment protects. And the founding generation wanted to make sure that everyone had a chance to say what they wanted, that people had access to all kinds of information, and that they could make sense of it for themselves. And that's a powerful strain in First Amendment thinking.
All right, well, let me just make the counter argument to that in terms of truthfulness in advertising. If Listerine can be forced to run remedial advertising since its original claim of killing 100% of all germs in your mouth was not true, and they were forced to run remedial advertising. This is many years ago. I haven't heard a recent case of anything like this. But let's say, since we can tell Listerine, look, you can't go out there and make a claim about your product that isn't true, and that's just mouthwash. How much more important would it be that advertising that can affect the outcome of who we elect to whatever the office is, how much more important would it be that advertising be held to a standard of truthfulness?
I think that's a perfectly valid point, and there are not a few states that have laws on the books, although not very vigorously enforced, that do punish people for making untruthful claims in political campaigns. The counterargument there is that truth is actually fairly hard to establish, and that the people in charge of establishing that truth might themselves be self-interested, might be from the other party. So it's a dangerous and a slightly un-American feeling thing to have a truth commission about statements of political views.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the number to call to join the program here. We're talking with Adam Liptak about what's going on in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. We've talked about a few cases. Are there any cases that you can talk about that we haven't mentioned that people should be interested in, what's either coming up or arguments have already been heard?
A couple of interesting cases coming up. There's a question about whether government entities like local town boards can open their meetings with a prayer from a chaplain of the month who's typically but not always Christian. There's a case about recess appointments, about when the president can bypass the Senate's usual power to confirm his appointees. So those are a couple of major cases. There's a housing discrimination case that asks whether you can use statistics or whether you need actual proof of intentional discrimination to bring a housing discrimination claim. It's a reasonably rich term. There's a case about whether you can have a zone around abortion clinics where protests are not allowed, which is, again, a major First Amendment question.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of Justice Scalia's comments about his news consumption?
I was disappointed. Just so readers know, he said he's given up on subscribing to the Washington Post. He's long ago given up on my employer, the New York Times, and he gets the Washington Times only, which is most people would say, a right-wing publication. So this is a little bit of an instance, John, of what you were talking about, where people go to their own news sources and find themselves in a kind of echo chamber. But apparently Justice Scalia thinks we're too liberal.
Hmm. Let's go to Luck, Wisconsin, and hear what Bob has to say this afternoon. Bob, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering with the current debate before the court, is there any bundling of the, like right now there's 19, but if it becomes unlimited, would somebody be able to take a bundle for any particular congressman or whatever, and so an individual wouldn't have to go through all the work of going to each congressman?
So if I understand bundling, and I don't claim to have special expertise, I think in a sense that's already allowed. You know, if someone wants to deliver a bunch of these $2,600 checks, that's permissible so long as each of them is authentically an individual contribution. But I think you may mean bundling in a different sense of somebody soliciting money on behalf of lots of candidates, on behalf of these 19 candidates I keep talking about, and in a sense becoming beholden to the contributor, not so much because the solicitor gets the money directly, but because you've done him the kind of favor that allows him then to deliver it to his colleagues. And I think that gives rise to a second kind of problem.
Well, and if you're giving directly to a political party, in effect, you're already doing that.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, we are out of callers, and we're pretty close to being out of time. Can you think of you mentioned some other cases here that are before the Supreme Court, would you characterize this as a more busy than usual or less busy than usual term for the court?
So we just got finished with two terms that really are blockbuster historical terms. One involving the President Obama's health care law. Two terms ago, last term, we had same-sex marriage and voting rights and affirmative action, and it's hard to say that this year is quite at that level, but I think it's fair to say that it's deeper in significant cases. So it's not a kind of boring term with a couple of enormous blockbusters, but more a series of interesting cases month after month.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? Let's just leave it there, and I'll say thank you so much for joining me this hour. Really appreciate your time this afternoon.
Great to be here.
Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour programming on the Kathleen Dunn Show. And Thanks to you, all of you, who contributed during Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive. Wow, more than 6,300 listeners pledged, including 1,600 sustainers and 1,300 brand new members of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wow, that's fantastic. You donated over $811,000 to fund WPR programs you depend on, programs like the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are very, very appreciative. Thank you so much. Well, tomorrow, a couple of really great hours. I've got a lot of books to read between now and tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and one of them will be by historian Jill Lepore. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock, I'll be talking about her latest biography that chronicles the life of Benjamin Franklin's youngest sister, Jane. The book was recently named a finalist for the 2013 National Book Award. Benjamin Franklin, very famous, very well-known, less well-known, his youngest sister, Jane. But she has some interesting insights, and historian Jill Lepore covers them in great detail, and we'll find out more about that coming up at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on the Kathleen Dunn Program. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.